Welcome to Double X Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, July 19th, 2013. I am Adrienne Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Jeannie Garbarino, biology editor at Double X Science. Welcome, Jeannie.
Hi, Adrienne. How are you?
This week, I'm wondering, what science topics interest you most?
As you know, I am a trained biologist, but I've been always studying fats and how they affect your cells. But one thing that I really am starting to get into is actually neuroscience, and that's probably a little cliche since neuroscience seems to be the big sexy topic these days. But I really do truly find it fascinating. I think it's brain plasticity is amazing, and the idea of reverse engineering the brain is kind of fascinating to me, even though that's very much impossible with where we are right now, technologically speaking. I just feel that it is really a frontier that we have not yet considered. I mean, we consider the oceans, we consider space, but our brain is just so incredible, and just learning how it works is just really fascinating to me. So I would like to become a neuroscientist now that I'm moving on to other
things. That's pretty cool. I think, too, you mentioned reverse engineering a brain, and that is something that you see possibly in science fiction. But to me, it's amazing how sort of predictive some science fiction is in terms of what we eventually do. And so even though people might laugh it off and be like, that's not possible, we might be surprised. I mean, people didn't think we could go to the bottom of the ocean 100 years ago, and then so Jules Verne wrote about it, and what he describes as the suit you wear, you know, to go there is very actually similar to what they ended up engineering and designing and that sort of thing. Now, maybe he wasn't accurate about the, you know, the monsters of the deep sea, but it doesn't right. matter. I think that's...
Well, he did have to sell
exactly.
the book, so...
So, I mean, that's one thing I think is really interesting. And you're right. I think the brain is a previously unexplored frontier that we finally have the tools to do stuff
with. And by unexplored, I don't think it's lack of trying. It's just now that our tools are catching up with our desire to explore, it's a really exciting time for neuroscience. So how about you? What science is interesting you the most these days?
I'm a chemist by training, and so I'm always interested in not necessarily new chemicals, but like the new applications and things they find out. But one thing I find really interesting, and especially in terms of science I communicate, is the intersection of science and parenting, because I find that there's a lot of misinformation and kind of touchy-feely information in parenting. And so I really like, for instance, our evidence-based parenting carnival that we partake in as Double X Science, and finding out what science is valid and what things aren't valid, or, you know, the overturning of previously thought good science and stuff. So that's one thing that always catches my interest, and I especially like to think about.
Yeah, I agree. Being an informed parent is so important. I actually went to the MoMA today for the Museum of Modern Art here in New York City for a field trip with my high school students. And we stopped and we looked at this painting by Andrew Wyeth, and it's called Christina's World. And basically what it depicts is a woman who is sort of sitting in this field, holding herself up with just her arms, but her legs are sort of just limp. And one of the students pointed out, oh, is she paralyzed from the waist down? And yes, the subject who Andrew was painting, her name was Christina, she was paralyzed from the waist down, and it was because of polio. And so the MoMA educator, I think, is looking at it in terms of subject matter and paint and canvas and lines and framing. And I'm thinking to myself, holy crap, this is a perfect painting to show that polio, which has been virtually eradicated in the United States by vaccination, you know, it was a reality for people who lived in a certain time frame. I just couldn't stop thinking about how vaccinations have really changed our lives.
And that it had such severe consequences. This person was paralyzed from the waist down because of this disease, right? So it wasn't they just got sick, right?
No. And it wasn't like they got into an accident. It was like a freak occurrence or, you know, something that just you couldn't control. This is something that now you can control. A vaccine-preventable disease, which people who opt out of vaccinations, I just don't understand the logic. And I think it's because we are so far removed from living in that time frame where it was a normal thing to know of someone who became paralyzed because of like polio or became ill because of smallpox.
And there's a lot of trust in the medical community and even the non-medical health community, right? That isn't necessarily valid. But my grandmother, who's 100, she worked in a hospital, and she talks about the people who are in these iron lungs. And, you know, they actually haven't improved the treatment very much since then. What they improved was they found a vaccination to prevent it. That's what they did. Yeah. So I think that, you know, some of these diseases, they come back and people are like, oh, but they're not going to be as bad because we have all this medical technology now. And it's not necessarily true. I mean, some people might get less sick, but some people are still going to have those terrible effects and consequences.
So you're right. So parenting and science and, you know, vaccination is just one tiny little piece of that framework, but parenting and science is an awesome overlap. You know, I agree.
So there's that. And then I also like in parenting and science, some of the more sociological aspects that are telling me about childhood development and what I can expect from my teenagers and the fact that their brains aren't fully formed and that's why they're behaving in this cranky manner, you know.
It's prefrontal cortex. That's what I've come to learn in my delving into neuroscience is you don't have a developed prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is what helps you to differentiate a good decision from a bad decision. And that's what I'm learning. I always say, oh, it's okay. The prefrontal cortex, it's just not developed yet. They're allowed to make bad decisions.
Yeah, and hopefully learn from them.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, that was a great discussion, Jeannie. Let's go ahead and find out what's been on XX Science since our last podcast.
So one of our posts since our last podcast came from Rebecca Schwartzlos, and she had written something called Armchair Genetics from Jamestown to Scott Brown, What Not to Assume About Race and Parenting. And I think this was prompted by that controversial, or it's really not controversial, but somehow it made a big splash in the news, was the Cheerios commercial that showed a biracial family. So I guess she is married to someone, an Asian Indian, and she has a child that has a different skin tone than her. And people are always like, oh, where did you get your baby from? Is she from Guatemala? Or assuming that she is from, you know, some country that she went to and adopted the baby, and she wants to, you know, give that snarky answer, like, my uterus. And I guess what she's highlighting in this post is that people don't really understand the difference between genetics and race and defining what race actually is. And so she discusses a book by Peter Wallenstein called Tell the Court I Love My Wife, which discusses the history of the laws on biracial children and interracial marriage, which is kind of interesting. She talks about the label mulatto, which came out of some of these legislative hearings in the early days of the United States. Mm-hmm. And she just discusses her own experiences as a mom within a biracial family. So it was really interesting to read this perspective and think about what does race mean? Where are the genetics involved? And what people are assuming when they see biracial families and how they are just, they basically have no concept of genetics when they make these decisions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I think most people have like a high school biology level education for biology. They think they know genetics from that because you get, you know, a chapter and an exam over that. And any science requires definitely more in depth than you get in high school. And, you know, people just, they look and they do this, what she calls armchair genetics. I really like this post because it was a interesting intertwine of both a personal experience and the science and the history. I mean, that just combined all those great aspects very well together. It was a very enjoyable read, although a little hard to read due to some of the things being said. I mean, racial issues are sometimes very difficult to read about.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand where people are coming from sometimes. I don't understand how people can be so biased.
Well, I think also it might shed a little bit of light on, in any sort of social justice issue, I think people don't realize their point of privilege necessarily until it's pointed out in just the right way. And so this one gave me some thought about, have I ever participated in armchair genetics? Am I saying something I shouldn't be saying? And so it's another wonderful aspect of this piece is hopefully it gets those who read it thinking, oh, what should I be doing?
Yeah, because if you're basing a lot of your viewpoints on just what your traditional viewpoints have been for your community or within your family, I mean, they may not fully reflect the wonderful melting pot that we live in and the fact that there are going to be so many mixed families because love is love. You're going to fall in love with someone and it's blind, I guess, to be cliche.
Yeah, this is a really engaging piece, so.
Yeah, glad that we had it here on Double X Science. It's a good perspective.
We also had a post more recently called Between Neurohype and Neuroskepticism with Bethany Brookshire, also known as Psycurious. And if you want to hear all about the post and all about Bethany's perspective, you can actually check out the post published on Monday, July 15th, wherein I got to have a wonderful conversation with her. So I encourage you. It's called Beyond the Post, Bethany Brookshire, Between Neurohype and Neuroskepticism.
We also had a piece called On Call, where Alexa C. Curzius asks, is constant digital access changing more than how we communicate? And she took a viewpoint where she focused on women and looked at how a huge percentage of women have a smartphone and what that means for communication. So you can definitely check out that post. So it's called On Call. Check it out on Double X Science.
With that On Call on Double X Science, we had a complimentary post on Double X Science Junior by one of our high school contributing bloggers called Reading Words on Screen versus Paper. And so that ties in really well for, is the screen changing more than how we communicate in our lives? And so she discusses specifically which aspects of reading, either on screen or on paper, what that's doing to our brain. So these are really complimentary, wonderful posts to read.
Great. We had another post by Tara Haley, who is our health editor here at Double X Science, and she wrote something called Maternal Abortion History No Longer a Risk for Preterm Birth. So it was previously believed that women who had an abortion and then became pregnant after that were more likely to have a preterm birth. But a new study that was released and then reported on by Tara has shown that maternal abortion history is no longer a risk factor. So it dispels a lingering sort of viewpoint that was never really clear for women's health or women's reproductive health.
Great. You can find all those posts at our website, doublexscience.org, by clicking to the links to the post title on the main page. In addition to our Double X Science site postings, our sister site, Double X Science Junior, had several postings since our last podcast, one of which was the aforementioned reading words on a screen versus on paper. We also had three posts that were biographies of scientists, and they were specifically biographies of women scientists, but they were going by the Finkbeiner test, wherein they actually don't mention the gender of these women. They don't mention anything but their science. So these are a great highlight and actually a wonderful way for people to read work on women scientists that follow the Finkbeiner test. So they covered Rosalind Franklin, Henrietta Leavitt, and Barbara McClintock. So if you're interested in any of these women or you haven't heard of them, there's some new ones that you can hear of.
I recently visited Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories, and I was able to see Barbara McClintock's lab space and the area where she grew her corn. So that was really, really neat for me. Yeah, cool. It was really excellent.
Fun. We had a couple physics-based ones. Quantum computing has arrived, and Richard Feynman and Feynman diagram basics. I would like to point out that our physics editor, Matthew Francis, did tell me after the posting what's highlighted in the post is not quite quantum computing. So what the company who's highlighted is, they're doing something slightly different. It, you know, kind of passes off as quantum computing, but it doesn't quite make the cut. So just as a note, of course, these are written by high school students, so the science is as understood by high school students. So, you know, keep that in mind. And the final post that has been posted since our last podcast is called A Big Issue. Haha. And this post, it's talking about, first, it gives an overview of a movie called The Bee Movie, which I've actually never seen, but it looks like it'd be really fun for little kids to watch, that she saw on an in-flight movie. And she then moved from this into the colony collapse disorder that has been going on for a number of years now, and some of the recent science on that and what people think might be the culprits and things that have been figured out are or are not part of the equation towards that. So it starts out from a fun point and goes into some pretty good science facts. So you can find these at xxsciencejr.blogspot.com. Or by following the link from the xxscience.org main page. So our news of the week is about Julia Parrish speaking at the White House about citizen science, where she was one of 12 champions of change invited to share her ideas on public engagement in science and science literacy. So this was of interest to me and the XX Science community because we're interested in science communication. We participate in a lot of promotion of science communication and go to conferences to do better in our own efforts at science communication. So I thought this was particularly important due to the fact that she's promoting citizen science, which I always try to promote in my various social media feeds.
Yeah, me too. I think citizen science is a very powerful way to make the public a little bit more engaged in science and perhaps even contribute to science literacy, which is a very important aspect for, especially for the future.
Yeah. One aspect I thought was interesting about Parrish was that the citizen science organization she founded was in 1991. And I was just a teenager then, not to give away my age, but I don't know if there were a lot of citizen science promotions. I feel like there might be more, like it's gaining some momentum now. And originally it had 12 volunteers, and now 23 years later, it's 850 volunteers. So, you know, this has got a lot of longevity and some stunning growth. So I see why she was picked to be one of these 12 people. She only got to speak for 11 minutes. So it's anyone who's given a scientific talk knows how hard it is to convey in 11 minutes anything. Yeah. And she spoke not only on her organization, but also the science that the organization does, because that's so very important in science communication and citizen science, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Parrish. So she is a professor at the University of Washington, and she studies aquatic and fishery sciences there. And so her citizen science projects basically looks at seabirds and seabird mortality and how things like oil spills or the changing climate affects mortality rates in seabirds. So I think it's a very important body of research, and I'm just thrilled to see that so many people are becoming more and more involved in her project, but in citizen science in general.
Yeah, it's great. And I will have a link to this story in the show notes. That wraps up our week at XX Science. Thank you, Jeannie, for joining me today.
You bet, Adrienne. It's always a pleasure to hang out and talk to you.
Likewise.
And stay tuned for some wonderful science that is upcoming on XX Science and XX Science Junior.
And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please rate our podcast and leave a review at iTunes or where your podcatcher allows reviews to help bring science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook at /XXScience and follow us on Twitter at XXSci. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrienne Rorick and Biology Editor Jeannie Garbarino. We are XX Science, bringing science to the women in you.